Hi, I'm Jen. I love watching horror movies. I also have PTSD and I go to a lot of therapy.
I'm Lara. I have anxiety and depression and love having the shit scared out of me. Wait, what?
I'm Mike. I'm a therapist and I love talking about horror movies and mental health.
We love horror films for how much they scare us and for how much they help us.
Because we love talking about mental health, aka how crazy we are, and the role the horror genre can play in our self-care, we started a podcast called Psychoanalysis.
Every episode, we talk about a movie and how it relates to a different topic in mental health and wellness. Whether it's a deep dive or a shorter episode in a movie that makes us feel all warm and fuzzy.
But not in a weird way.
Unless we're talking about hot horror sweaters, because then it is very weird.
True.
Very weird.
Our episodes drop every Thursday on the Consequence Podcast Network. Listen to find out
how horror can heal.
Consequence Podcast Network.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. I'm your host for today, Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman, but I'm also not here alone. I'm not your only host. Here with me is...
This is Jen Franny Adams, and I cannot wait to talk about my favorite character today.
I know, and you do get to talk about your favorite character a little bit more, because, you know, as we discussed in our last recap episode, The Circle Closes... I mean, that might be the last time we talk about Franny for a very, very, very long time, but this is kind of a nice little bonus episode because, as we teased in that recap, we did get to speak to showrunner Benjamin Cavell again, and we talked about a lot. We talked about Stephen King's new Coda. We talked about Vegas. You got to talk a little bit about Franny with him, which I think he enjoyed.
Yep, and the well, because, you know,
oh, yeah.
I'll go back to that well over and over again.
Yeah, no pun intended, but or
no,
actually,
no.
maybe pun intended. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. But we talked about a lot, and, you know, we got to talk about some deleted scenes or maybe maybe some scenes that were cut and maybe, you know, whether or not you get to see him again. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we got to discuss. So instead of just us blabbering about it, why don't you just jump ahead and listen? Because it's an actually fairly long conversation. We initially were going to go for 30 minutes, but we ended up talking for I think close to an hour. So so enjoy the conversation and we'll see you on the other side. Hello. Hey, how you doing?
I'm Hi. Great. How are you?
Good. Great to talk to you again. This is
back at you.
It's wild to think that it's already reached its end. I mean, I guess just that's just life in itself, you know.
I know.
So how does it feel? I mean, now that we're at the end, December still feels like it was just yesterday. The whole premiere, everything just feels like it's yesterday. But has it been, you know, like a blur for you?
Yes, and December also in some way feels like it was about 1,000 years ago. I mean, the amount of stuff that we've been through since December. But yeah, no, listen, it does, you know, it's a funny thing with these sort of limited event series and the, you know, the pros and cons of kind of releasing them all together or releasing them one at a time. And I go back and forth on it, frankly. I mean, I think there is something lovely about releasing them one at a time and trying to sort of have this shared ongoing experience as everybody sort of waits for the next one. But, you know, you're crafting the thing as, I mean, you know, everybody keeps saying, well, these event series, it's like a 10-hour, 9-hour, 8-hour, I mean, 9-hour in our case, movie. And then to sort of release it piecemeal when you've crafted it to be, you know, a full piece of work. You know, that's funny too. So it's just, you know, it's just interesting to see what the differences are and what people sort of make of it as it rolls out one by one, you know, sort of each chapter. And then when they see where it was going, it's like, oh, maybe they have a different feeling about what came before. It's just interesting.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I've noticed that with when we rewatch. I mean, whenever we got to the next chapter, I would always rewatch the one beforehand, just for added context. And it really does kind of change your perspective once you've actually seen the next chapter. So I do think mm-hmm. that there is value for, and I think a lot of actual fans and constant readers are definitely going to be waiting to this last week to finally binge it all. I know I've been seeing that in a lot of our discourse online, just being like, well, I'm waiting until it's all out. You know?
Yeah, it does seem like that's the way a lot of people are sort of dealing. You know, I mean, how can you say enough about how all this has changed people's viewing habits? But it does seem like, you know, it does seem like even with the places, because not so many places are dropping them all at once anymore. I mean, obviously yeah. Netflix does and a couple other, but even with the sort of one at a timers, like, I don't know, like Apple, like All Access or Paramount Plus or whatever will be by the time this interview runs. no, but it does feel like people sort of make their own, you know, full drop, right? They're like, oh no, I'm not going to start it until they're all available. And then I'm just going to binge it like I do Stranger Things or something, which is, again, you know, completely obviously valid and even an interesting way to watch. Yeah, no, it's fun to be part of, you know, this moment when the industry and the sort of the way people consume these things is changing so much, and also to see how much of it stays the same and how much of it is still based on the rules of drama and stuff that, you know, that Aristotle was writing about.
Seriously. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting how it's boomeranging again, because, you know, obviously with the Netflix model, when, you know, starting with like House of Cards and yada, 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 it did really kind of feel like, all right, well, we got the binge mode going on. But you're right. Like, over the last year and a half, or I guess Disney Plus was really big on it, because the whole, you know, rolling out of The Mandalorian and now even with like WandaVision, sure. I think I do think that the industry has like been able to see the value in going back to that week to week, because obviously the discourse and the commentary is just, it just keeps going, you know, as opposed to, you know, you mentioned Stranger Things. I'm a huge Stranger Things fan. I just remember after that 4th of July weekend, it was like, you know, you'd see little whispers of it here and there after that. But for the most part, like, it was like an explosion, and then all of a sudden it stopped. And so I think there's like an interesting middle ground there, which for me personally, covering this week to week has been a joy, because it's made it nostalgic for me. And I think that that nostalgic is also tied in the idea that we're able to kind of take this through piecemeal and get the themes and arcs in a little more fascinating way. I think you're able to meditate it with that I think is important to do, especially with a, you know, source material as dense as this.
Yeah, no question. And certainly our, you know, our hope, our goal, and I think, you know, our success has been that I think there's a lot to unpack and to sort of discover, you know, about the episodes that may not be completely obvious on a first watch, or may not be completely obvious when, you know, I don't know, like, I guess like any good work of fiction or good movie, that, you know, there is a level on which you enjoy it the first time. And then when you go back with the context of everything that comes and you kind of, you know, dig into it again, that there's more to be discovered. And that's, I don't know. I think that's what you're aspiring to, I suppose.
Totally.
As a creator.
And yeah. I think especially when it's a story that a lot of people know so well, you know, I know sometimes if there's a difference to the story, like, I need a little time to unpack it and then really look at what the changes are doing, you know? And so I think it's been really nice to kind of be able to step back after an episode and just unpack what it was, you know, and kind of let it work on me, and also to be excited for the next episode. You know,
I agree. I do miss that about the binging. I mean, I guess you're excited because at a certain point you have to go to sleep and you're like, all right, well, I'm right. excited to watch this tomorrow. But yeah. But no, I do like, I don't know at the when Lost was at its height, mm-hmm. that's what I always kind of come back to, just how mm-hmm. excited I was when there was going to be a new episode of Lost and just how much I was looking forward to it and speculating about it. And I, you know, and listen, I think Game of Thrones became like that, The Sopranos became like that, but yeah. you know, these things that I guess it's a fairly rare thing in this day and age that everybody is kind of anticipating and waiting and watching something at the same time. But when something hits like that and really becomes, I don't know, part of the cultural conversation and part of sort of what everybody is thinking about and picturing and wondering about, that's really fun. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's, yeah, not, I'm, by the way, I'm not saying that we are that, or that we have a sort of Lost level of, you know, fan anticipation, but I see that there is, no matter how fun it is to binge stuff, there is value in that, you know, just that collective anticipation and that collective experience of waiting for something until it becomes available and then all, you know, jumping on it together.
Well, it feels like you're on a road together. And I think that, you know, and honestly, it's been a hell of a road that's been, you know, long and winding. And the last time we chatted, I mean, we had actually not even gotten to Vegas yet. And so, you know, obviously we're going to be talking about the Coda, which is just absolutely gorgeous and mm-hmm. very, just lots to unpack there. But I kind of wanted to go back just a little bit and talk about Vegas, just because we didn't really get to hear from like the conceptualization of it from you. And I wanted to know what the discussions were like in adapting that version of Vegas and the differences you made from either King's novel or, you know, things that you brought to the table yourself. Like, what were the discussions like in conceptualizing Sin City?
So, you know, I guess a big change, we never understood that, you know, in the book, Vegas is a place where drug use seems mm-hmm. to be punishable by, you know, horrible public death. And, you know, we actually see in the book somebody getting executed for drug use. And mm-hmm. that, I don't know, maybe that played differently in 1978. I guess it just didn't feel like that would be something that a guy like Flagg would crack down on, that mm-hmm. at least he would be sort of advertising a kind of, you know, freedom, but of course, you know, in the style of an authoritarian, you know, freedom would equal imprisonment. I mean, you know, that mm-hmm. that it would be freedom within these very narrow constraints, but the sort of the bottom line would be that you had to do whatever was best for him. And it was also very important to us that Vegas, that we not just discount all the ways in which Vegas would have to be functioning as a society that was providing services. And that certainly are, you know, the Hoover Dam and that, you know, finding Dana there working and then sort of tying that and the power being generated there to the power being back on the Strip was, you know, that was very intentional as our mm-hmm. introduction to Vegas. And that was a way in which we, you know, I think that really is in the book, that this Vegas society is not just a place of hedonism and debauchery, but also a place where, you know, there are schedules and people are working and you know, that in some ways life is, at least early on, easier than it is in Boulder, where mm-hmm. there's less kind of, you know, top down, just draconian control. And so it's taking them longer to get the power back on and do these things and make their lives easier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was very important to us that Vegas seemed like a place, you know, that we not just present Vegas as a place of evil, but as a place where you could actually see people potentially going and feeling protected and sort of cared for, in the sense that they were, you know, they have power and they have food and there's a party going on for their off time. And, you know, that we not make Vegas seem like, oh, well, you would only go there if you are just inherently evil, but that that we really get at some of the appeal of a guy like Flagg, particularly in these circumstances in which these people find themselves in this sort of horror show that they're thrust into, where it's like, oh, well, you know, what is the appeal of a kind of charismatic strongman? I mean, I think that's a question we've been asking ourselves in the real world for the last little bit, but by the way, I'm not even just referring to Trump. I mean, that sort of leader seems to be ascendant, or at least has been ascendant for the last few years or whatever around the world, in a way that, I don't know, really seemed to have been on the wane, I guess, after the fall of, I don't know, after the fall of the Soviet Union. But that authoritarian strongman cult of personality that has now taken hold in places like Brazil and, all sorts of places. I think we all felt that if we were making the stand in 2020, we needed to be getting at some of the appeal of that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And what they're offering and how they're presenting the world. You know, they're presenting the world as this very scary place, which obviously in the stand it is, and they're presenting themselves as the person who can protect you, citizen, from that scary world, and actually carve out an existence that isn't just misery and fear, but that, you know, that has some pleasure and some entertainment and some, you know, some actual comfort in it, in which you can go to a place with the lights on and music playing. Yeah. And
yeah, because there's an appeal to like being able to make the trains run on time, which and especially when it feels like the world is falling apart. I love how it feels like, because he's leading through fear. And I love, like, we see with Lloyd when that fear like shows through. And I just think that's such a fascinating read, especially related to like what's going on in the world right now. And one of the lines that we noticed was when he's giving his big speech, Flagg is giving his big speech. And he's talking about how Captain Trips wasn't the real apocalypse. The real apocalypse is these people, these other people trying to tell you how to live your life. And I thought that was so fascinating, because it's just like a way of painting reality to suit Flagg's needs. And we kind of read that as like this like Trumpian optimism and deception and like really leading through fear again. Are we on the right page with that?
I think absolutely. I mean, I think that we were very aware of not wanting to have Flagg just be a Trump avatar. I mean, I think that that would sort of reduce the whole thing and not be really faithful to the book. I mean, he's not a Trump avatar, but certainly, you know, there are these commonalities in how, you know, how guys like this characterize the world. And I think, you know, I think it's this fundamental sort of difference of, I don't even know that it's a difference of opinion, but it's just a different way of looking at nature and sort of the natural state of things and thinking, well, wait, I mean, maybe there is not an equilibrium where, you know, everyone has enough and, you know, everybody is kind of rewarded based on their, you know, their service or the amount that they contribute. You know, maybe Flagg has a point when he says, you know, nature contains winners and losers, predators and prey. I mean, obviously we as human beings have tried to, at least not be at the mercy of natural impulses and natural equilibrium, and we've made societies and laws and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is a strain certainly in people who support lots of these authoritarian regimes where they just think that the idea of everybody living together in harmony is sort of hopelessly naive, and that, you know, that all that's going to do is let people who are, you know, ruthless in the way that nature intends kind of take advantage of you. If you're really trying to achieve this harmony that is just never gonna, never gonna be viable and, you know, always gonna be seized on by somebody looking to have an advantage. That's just, you know, that's just a pipe dream and a recipe for you to wallow in horror forever, you know, for you to never end up in a livable life. And I mean, that's a very, it's a very pessimistic and, but not quite nihilistic, but certainly a pessimistic and depressing view of humanity and of the world. But you know, I don't know. Flag never promised that he wasn't going to be at least a little depressing.
Oh yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think the coda is so paramount for not only the story, but even just right now. I mean, one of the things I kind of gleaned from it, especially the second time around, was just how much its themes of rebuilding seem to really strike home as, you know, as our country kind of similarly unifies in a way. And I wonder, you know, it's no secret that King is, you know, a little political, I'd say.
Sure.
You know, just glance over his Twitter. I think it's pretty clear. But I wonder, do you think this was going on in his mind with the coda, like that he was maybe trying to drill some of these themes in it? Or do you think it's just coincidence?
No, I'm sure. I mean, look, you know, it is also true. I mean, as you know, as I think you're implying, I mean, it is also true that he had been planning a version of this coda at least for, you know, 30 years and the, you know, the real genesis of it from then, at least, you know, according to him, and I guess I'll trust him. The real the real genesis of it for him was, you know, just that Franny didn't get to participate in the stand. You know, she can't walk to Vegas with them, right? She's 8 months pregnant when they leave, and, you know, therefore she never gets to like actually confront the Dark Man, and that just, you know, I know that always aided him because he loves Franny and felt, you know, feels that she is one of the, you know, couple few protagonists of the novel, and so the fact that she doesn't really get to participate in the climax is tough and felt like a, you know, a I don't know, an unstruck an unstruck bell or something, whatever that is, 1 o'clock half struck. But you know, it just felt like that was always a kind of, you know, a hanging chad for him. You know, he didn't feel like she had gotten a satisfying conclusion to her story.
Yeah.
And you know, so that's the genesis of it. But I'm sure, and I imagine he would tell us that, you know, recent events. I mean, you know, I guess he wrote it for us in 2018, but even by then he was clearly responding to, you know, this Trumpian strain in American politics and in American life. And I think, yeah, I think we can't discount that as you know, something that informs how he portrays Flag, how he portrays, you know, her temptation and Flag's appeal and Flag's kind of, I don't know, just relentless pursuit of power and personal gain.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things that I particularly loved about the coda, and I'm a sucker for Franny, she's my favorite character in my favorite book, so I loved that she got to have her moment of choice. And I think it kind of updates the story, because throughout the book, King writes, those things are all waiting around for people to pick them back up. And I think what the coda really shows is the things are all waiting, but there are still also people there who decide to pick them up or not. And I love that we see Franny get to make that choice, and that's kind of what I read as the purpose of the coda. And I have a couple more questions about that later, but I'm wondering, what was the original ending? Was it going to end kind of the way the book does with them in Boulder?
Well, I mean, we had always, I don't want to make it seem as though we had sort of written an ending and then we had always been talking from the beginning about, you know, King had made us aware early on that he had this, this new ending that he had been rolling around in his head. Now, you know, there was a question for a while about whether he was going to actually write it and kind of trust us to do it. But, you know, we were certainly, we were always breaking the show, leaving that open. I mean, we felt like we wanted to, you know, to be true to the book. And so we were going to end it. I mean, we had always kind of assumed that we would end it with some version of, you know, I know this is a huge spoiler, but I know it's not running until the everything's
after
out.
The fact. Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We had always figured just because I don't know, I loved that ending to the expanded edition, you know, of Flag kind of finding himself. I mean, I loved it for all sorts of reasons. I loved it because Flag finds himself on this beach and approaches this uncontacted tribe. And I thought that was so interesting and so cool that, you know, of course there would be these pockets of the earth that really had never been touched by Captain Trips because they don't really have commerce with, you know, the world outside of that. But I also love that that Flag kind of wakes up not really knowing what's happened to him, not really knowing kind of who he is, but having some idea, but not a kind of complete memory of of what's just happened. I love that. I mean, I love that he is both. It sort of highlighted him for me as not all powerful, which, you know, King is always at great pains to remind us, you know, in the book that there are these things that he doesn't know or that he can't do, but also that he's relentless. I mean, that you can never kind of just vanquish that kind of avarice and that kind of self-interest and that, I don't know, that kind of character and that strain of humanity that is willing to, I don't know, exploit people's fears and mistrusts and you know, to exploit some of the worst and most base impulses in, you know, in humanity. That kind of person is never going to completely disappear, and you have to be willing to confront them wherever they rear their head.
Yeah. Well, and we get a lot of inclusion of Kaa. I can't remember if you actually say the word Kaa, but there's definitely mention of the wheel, and the wheel keeps turning.
Indeed.
And that you just have to keep wearing, and that the story doesn't ever really end, which I love. And I'm just wondering, like, how you kind of see the coda as like a summation of the themes of the entire book.
No, I think you just put your finger on it. I mean that, well, but that there is no, I so admire about King generally, but you know, particularly in this context, that, you know, you seem to be building toward this kind of like, oh, we're gonna vanquish evil once and for all. Mm-hmm. But first of all, well, what exactly is evil, right? I mean, that
right.
As is made very explicit in the book, you know, that nuke in Vegas kills the wicked and the righteous alike, you know, and you know, is Flag and is or are all of his followers just evil? I think that's too easy, and I think you know, I think that this idea of a kind of constant and ongoing, never ending struggle against, you know, the worst and most divisive or divisive impulses of ourselves and of each other. I mean, I think that is the task, I suppose, that at least in King's mind that we set for ourselves. It's like, no, it's not enough to be good in the sense that, okay, you know, you're gonna take on the evil and beat it back, and then everything's roses for the rest of, you know, the rest of your life. It's not a little sort of, you know, as Harold says, one stroke of cruelty or whatever, and it sets everything right. It's like, no, that's actually a very facile kind of misunderstanding of life and of human history and of struggle. It's a constant ongoing struggle against the forces of I don't know, charismatic authoritarianism and people who would take advantage of the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a He Who Walks Behind the Rose vibe in the cornfield, which I loved, and that he like is always walking behind there.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you were kind of leaning into some of the, because as you probably know, like he writes about flag in a lot of different ways. And...
I do know. Yeah. Yes. No. Yes. And look, the answer is of course. I mean, we were leaning into some of it, but we were also very aware of not wanting to, you know. And look, I don't know. You go back and look at The Stand. It's like, did he know when he was presenting the flag of The Stand that would also be the, or a version of that character would be in all these other places and have all this other context? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I suppose that's an open question, but we were very aware and talked explicitly about not wanting the audience to have to kind of know the rest of the flag. I don't know, not to have the context of all the stuff we learn about Flag and the Dark Tower and just, you know, not to bring that to it, but certainly to allow that. I mean, that is, our universe certainly makes room for that to be the same flag and for him mm-hmm. to, you know, have all those other appearances. And as you say, I mean, there's certain parts that we are referencing in places, but yes, but also we very much wanted our flag to be able to stand on his own in the way that the flag from the novel has to, right? I mean, especially when the novel first came out and there wasn't any of that other context, mm-hmm. certainly in a way that people could learn about. But yeah, I mean, so that was something we were definitely explicitly aware of leaning into, but not leaning into too far, I guess.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's really effective too. I mean, and I love the idea that you kind of get to, you know, it's, you know, you have your cake, you need it too with Flag here. And Skarsgård just really comes alive in this chapter particularly. And I wondered if it was because maybe he was detached from Vegas at this point, you know, like there's like a little more laissez-faire quality to his,
right.
You know,
no, I think that's very true. I mean, you know, the idea that suddenly this guy actually, I figure even for these guys who don't take their responsibility as leaders seriously, there's still something exhausting just about having to sort of manage, I mean, even if they're doing it in a half-assed way, but having to manage that many people and that many, mm-hmm. you know, supposed loyalists, and having to be so kind of, you know, it's having to be so on guard for any hint of, you know, of disloyalty or dissent. I mean, that there's something about that sounds just exhausting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I like the idea of Flag, you know, sitting there against a tree, kind of like, okay, yes, he lost, but it's like, well, at least I get to take a breath. I mean,
yeah, right. It's like unemployed Flag in a way.
totally.
which is kind of cool. I mean, I love that about him. And it really kind of shows a different side to him that we don't really get to see so much in the rest of the series. Cause you're right. Like, he is like, all right, we got the mission here. I got to get this shit done. I got X, Y, and Z to hit. So that aspect I thought was a lot of fun. And I wondered if it was contagious from a writing perspective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, I think, and we certainly tried to honor it, but the flag in the book is really presented as an opportunist, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he's been wandering the roads. You have the sense, kind of the roads of America, I don't know about forever, but for an awfully long period of time, sort of, you know, and then sees this opportunity in this accident that happens in a lab. I mean, that's very true to the book, that he kind of seizes on the opportunity and makes the most of it. And that's, I think, are you know, that is our vision of Flag as the ultimate opportunist who, you know, sees his chance and goes after it with his whole self. But mm-hmm. then when he gets set back and it's like, all right, this, you know, that opportunity didn't work out and you need to kind of regroup and whatever, he's, you know, that's okay too. He understands that he needs to restore himself a bit and mm-hmm. you know, no, I love that. And it was very, yes, it was definitely intentional.
Yeah,
because yeah. There's always going to be another opportunity, you mm-hmm. know.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's
potentially a wheel. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. No, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that is the what's behind Flag's attitude. There is that. All right. You know. You win this round. Whatever. Yeah. I get it. I got hit by lightning. I got. You know. But yeah. I'm here. I'm biding my time.
It's right. Like shit happens. It'll hit the fan again, and I'll
yeah.
be there.
Yeah, no, exactly. That,
and I'll be waiting.
Totally.
Well, I wanted to ask about something else that King uses kind of throughout his work is this imagery or symbol of the well, which I loved in this episode. And I was just wondering how you see the well relating to Franny's story and kind of as of the series as a whole.
Wow. That's a great question. I mean, I want to tell you that I have a great answer for it about I don't know about the life-giving powers of water, and I don't know. I mean, you know, certainly look, the well as metaphor has that's been a sort of a trope in drama and in writing for a very long time, and I guess you can see why in some way, right? I mean, it's yeah. not only digging into the earth for the kind of the blood that is, you know, the key to all life, right? Which mm-hmm. is water. But it's also, you know, it also becomes a trap. I mean, you know, it becomes something, right? You're kind of going in there to get this, to get this life-giving fluid, and then it becomes a thing that you can't get out of, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I that may not be a very deep version of the metaphor, and I'm a little reluctant to kind of lean too heavily into the metaphor itself, just because I cringe when that stuff comes through, you know, in a drama and in a piece of entertainment when the metaphors are too overt. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, of course you're onto something. I mean, of course the well and the well in King's oeuvre and the well in King's mind, of course is a, you know, a place, I don't know, a place of that gives life and renewal, and also a place of potential horror.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, how on hands or hands on, sorry, was King with the filming and the production of this, or did he just kind of turn in the script and it was just like, go at it?
That's right. I mean, look, you know, Owen King was, I mean, he was a producer and he was in the writer's room with us all the time, and you know, and he came to Vancouver to, I mean, just to visit for a bit and be on set and whatever. So I mean, Owen was very involved moment to moment. I mean, King himself, you know, he read all the scripts and you know, gave notes as he wanted, which turned out to be, I don't know, not he was really supportive and enthusiastic. And in fact, after he had read the first couple episodes or the first drafts that we sent him, that's when he said, okay, I'm going to write this coda. You guys clearly have a vision for this show and you clearly know what you're doing. And I, mm-hmm. Yes, you guys are going to do this righteously. And you know, that was kind of, I don't know, that was so reassuring to us that he was, you know, buying into our vision for it. Look, he's had so many things adapted, and I don't mean to say that it's old hat for him, because it's not, in terms of, you know, there are these works of his that he really, I mean, I'm sure he cares about all of them, but that he really cares about in particular, and that he knows, you know, are so resonant for people, right? I mean, he knows what the ones are that have really just taken hold, and that people have, you know, these incredible long-term relationships with. So he is, I don't mean to say he's precious about The Stand in a, you know, in a way that doesn't allow adaptation, but he's precious about it in the sense that he's certainly very invested in it being adapted in a way that he can enjoy and get behind. I mean, he certainly feels protective of it. But part of that is, you know, he's been through this so much that he knows that, look, if he's going to make it the way he did with the first one, you know, and he's going to write every episode and whatever, well, then that is one thing. But if he's going to trust somebody else to do it and to bring their artistic vision to it, that he understands that you can't sort of be halfway in that, right? You can't just kind of, I don't know, from the sidelines sort of throw grenades and you know, have sort of little suggestions that are, of course, because they're coming from you, enormous suggestions that everybody's then scrambling to make work, but, you know, you're not kind of keeping the overarching vision in your head. So, you know, one of the great gifts he gave us was to say, he actually wrote an email to me at some point when I was kind of asking him, you know, well, do you think we're thinking about going, you know, changing this slightly, or how do you feel about that? And he just, you know, he had read however many episodes by then, and he said, you know, look, you clearly know what show you're making. It's great. It's you know, it's got this consistent voice. He ended it with "Go on with your bad self," which I cherish, but which we took to heart. It was like, okay, yeah. he gets it. He's an artist. He's a writer. Uh-huh. He understands. Yeah, at a certain point, if you have a vision and if you're going with it, you can't be in a position of sort of, I don't know, second guessing yourself or allowing somebody else to second guess you. You have to be, you know, you have to be doing it. And him telling us, you know, I love what you're doing. I mean, whether he loves every decision or every change is almost beside the point. I mean, and kind of is beside the point. It's like, no, I am behind this as a writ large, as an artistic expression and an adaptation of my work, and therefore go on with your bad self.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a great button, and it honestly really does work not only just for the series, but even if you were able to get something that was actually typed out and written in story format, I think it would really actually just wedge in to the book, and me especially too. With the actual coda that we do get with, you know, Flag on the Island. But looking back on the season, you know, just as a whole now, there's just so many arcs. And I wanted to ask, you know, just basically some like finish line, you know, final lap questions to you. And one of them is, you know, what arc do you think you're most satisfied with? Because there are certainly some main through lines here, and, you know, those that we discussed in our previous interview. But I'm just wondering, what's the one that you think is from beginning to end, the one that you're most proud of?
That is a lovely question. I mean, I guess I'm very proud of Harold's arc, even though I think, you know, I think a lot of that, or much of that, is there in the book. I guess I would argue that I'm very proud of the way we rendered Harold's arc, and Owen is Owen Teague is just, I don't know, he's brilliant. He seemed to me to show us like every emotion for Harold. I mean, every little color on the way from where he starts to where he ends. I just can't say enough about Owen's performance. I'm really very proud of Lloyd's arc, because I feel as though the Lloyd in the book, I don't know, I never quite, you know, when you meet him in the book, he seems to be on board. You find him killing people who he's never met and really doesn't have anything against. I mean, that's sort of how you come upon him. He's with Poke, and Poke is the crazier one, but Lloyd seems, you know, kind of every bit bought in. And then there's this moment late in the book when he resists killing Glenn Bateman. And I never, I've never quite understood that in the book. Like we met him and he didn't have a problem with killing people that had never done him wrong. And listen, maybe that's a kind of arc where he goes from being completely willing to being, you know, to resisting, but I don't know. That was difficult to wrap our heads around. And I think with Nat Wolff, who I also think is brilliant and was so committed to the part, I think we found, and with Taylor Elmore, you know, who's my partner, who I brought in to kind of help me shepherd the thing through production. You know, Taylor and Nat and I really, really worked on, you know, creating an arc for that character that we all could stand behind and that we all could follow. And I think, I don't know, I, for me at least, we really get it where you totally believe, you believe how hard it is on him when he does kill Glenn. And then you believe the turn he makes when he finally decides to defy Flag. And I'm also, you know, I have to say, if we're talking about arcs, which is just a great question. I mean, I'm proud of the way in which we make it explicit that, you know, the strength of our protagonists and their ability to defy Flag and to defy him in front of his people really does seem to be part of what leads to his downfall, you know, that none of it feels coincidental, and that Trash Can Man isn't happening to show up at the moment that they're, you know, preparing to execute the spies or the pilgrims or whatever we want to call them who've come from Boulder, but that, you know, that these things are all tied together and that it is, you know, it's Larry's strength and his sort of his kind of quiet defiance that starts to turn the crowd against Flag, and that it's, you know, they're turning against him and they're the reduction of their adulation, which obviously we saw the adulation be the fuel for his levitating. You know, that actually drains his power, that he seems to be gaining power from their kind of blind love, and that, you know, that our protagonists really, really do contribute to his defeat by showing the defiance that they do.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
And I think that's kind of a through line in a lot of King's work, is what is on the inside of these big villains that seem so over the top. Is
totally.
Are they real inside, you know? And I love the way you conveyed that. The moment where he starts to descend, it was one of my favorite moments of the season.
Oh, good. Good, good,
and
good.
I was wondering if you had any other favorite scenes or favorite episodes or favorite moments.
I mean, I just along those lines, I love the scene of Glenn and Ray and Larry in the jail cell, and Glenn saying, you know, Glenn saying the thing that I think is true, but that maybe you're not aware of until he says it, which is that, you know, crucifying people along the Vegas Strip isn't strength, that's weakness. It means you don't trust the rest of the people, and you have to make these examples about what happens if people defy you. I mean, I love that insight, and I love the character of Glenn and the way Greg plays it. I just think is so right on. But I mean, look, there's so many scenes in the thing. I mean, I love because also we just watched episode 8. I mean, the courtroom scene I can't get enough of, but look, the first scene of Flag meeting Lloyd at the at the bars of the cell, Larry and Rita in the park, Harold and Fran in the basement when she's found the bomb making stuff, their performances in that scene, the dinner scene between Harold and Fran and Stu, I loved that one. Love Jay. I mean, Jay, by the way, James Marsden, it's funny, you know, I worked on Unjustified for 6 seasons, and I always would say, you know, that in some way, Tim Oliphant is I mean, I don't know if he was the most underrated actor on television, but I think people discount how hard it is to do what those guys, I mean, I'm yeah. not saying that Tim and James are the same kind of actor, but to play that kind of stoic hero, but to uh-huh. do it with a real, well, first of all, a real gleam and mm-hmm. some real sort of some humor and self-awareness, but also some real depth and, you know, not just to be the kind of two-dimensional white hat, you know, cartoonish guy, but to, you know, to really convey it and to really have that guy come through. I think that is not easy. And there are not a lot of people who can do it.
No, and he does such a good job with it here. I mean, like even in The Walk, when he's, you know, one of the things we noted in our episode recast is just when Marston has to deliver, the monologue of sorts to them to basically convince him to keep going. You know, it's so easy to sit there and you know, he's a hunk to flex his hero muscle. He could do that. But the fact that he dialed it down to kind of be the as you're saying, like this hero that doesn't have the answers all the time, but has the conviction. Like that's yeah. There's a nuance there that really is, I think that people do take that for granted for sure.
Yeah. Well, he makes it look easy. I mean, that's that's the curse. It's like, well, if you're going to make it look that easy, then people are going to think it's easy. But I at a certain point they start to realize, well, wait, why can nobody else do this? There are only a couple people I've ever seen be able to do it. No, he's, he's just amazing. And by the way, he also is, I don't know, he's one of the small handful of human beings who looks great in 4K HDR. You know, we got these crazy monitors to make sure that, you know, everything was, because obviously we had to cut this remotely. And so we couldn't even go into a post-production facility. So we we got this incredibly fancy monitor installed temporarily installed in my house and our VFX supervisors house it was kind of a marvel to see that even at that level of resolution, which is I don't know that human beings are meant to be photographed at, but still even then James Morrison seems to have no pores and no blemishes. Like I don't understand what is happening here. How can that be? James Morrison and Tom Brady apparently are the two guys on earth who are just never going to age, you know, all just look more interesting and sort of leaner and cooler as they get older. It's like, well, okay.
He makes those Entertainment Weekly reunions that much harder for everyone else.
Oh my God. No question.
Well, you know, one of the things I also loved about this series is just the music. I mean, we talked about needle drops last time, but we've had some great needle drops since then. And I've just been listening to the playlist like nonstop. And I think on like smoke breaks for me, I'm always playing on The Stranger being like, you know, oh, look, it's Flag. But I wanted to ask you, what's your favorite needle drop this season? The one that you're really proud of adding to the Stanmore?
Well, I'm certainly proud for all sorts of reasons of Brand New Key that ends episode 2. And by the way, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I promise that we had it in the script as a comment on, and because it's a fun song, but as a comment on Flag giving Lloyd the key before we cast Heather Graham / Roller Girl in that part in 2. But I love that we ended 2 with the Roller Girl theme song for obvious reasons. I'm very proud of the needle drop at the end of 9. I think the Stand, I think it doesn't play without some sense of humor. I think that is one of the wonderful things about King, and one of the ways in which King's version of an apocalypse or a post-apocalypse still has some fun in it, some like real genuine fun. And, so some of the needle drops obviously have humor in them. But I think that's faithful to the source material. And of course I love, you know, well, I don't know. I'm just precious about all our needle drops, I guess. I love where we fit in. Don't Fear the Reaper. I know
that was my favorite.
Everybody was kind of waiting for it. And uh-huh. I want you to know there were these discussions about, well, it's like everybody's waiting for it. You don't want to give it to them right uh-huh. up front. That feels weird. But, you know, anyway, I think we found a great place for it, and his kind of
his face.
Cheshire Cat smile.
Oh, yeah. That's what makes like it. It's
Joker
perfect.
/ Jesus Jim Christ. Carrey. I don't know what. But And by the way, I do want to mention, there's also Space Song in as they're crossing the bridge uh-huh. out of a destroyed mm-hmm. Manhattan in episode 2. But Season Kent, our music supervisor, Space Song, for example, she found, you know, a bunch of songs. Space Song, I didn't even know. But she found and suggested a bunch of songs that are just... that are just so good. And then also our composers, Nate Walcott and Mike Mogis. They did such beautiful work with the score, and also, you know, they partnered with this guy Duran Jones to write and record Baby Can You Dig, and I just think that version is dynamite.
I agree.
I love what they did.
Yeah, it sounds like a real hit. I mean, that's what we were saying when it plays exactly. It sounds natural. Like, it doesn't sound like, you know, when you hear those made for the movie soundtrack, it just sounds absolutely organic. And I love, God, I've been listening to like Franny writing nonstop mm-hmm. lately. It's just like one of the most like gorgeous, like there's some beauty and mournful at the same time.
Yeah.
Just really nailed it in terms of especially capturing that sort of rustic Americana. Aspects to it. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
But
good.
So, you know, I don't want to take too much of your time, because I know that we've definitely gone over. but I did wonder, you know, last time when we spoke, you'd said that you'd be interested in The Running Man. And I wondered if this is your last foray into King's Dominion for now, or if you have maybe discussed returning to Stephen King down the road, you know, if that's going to, you know, happen.
I mean, I guess the answer is we'll wait and see. I mean, I I've loved my Stephen King experience, and I really don't know. I can't say enough about him and how wonderful he's been throughout this. So the idea of, you know, doing something in the King universe again, and of working with Owen King again, because Owen King turns out to be just a wonderful writer and a wonderful guy, but you know, and has a great sense of story and structure. The idea of doing something with them again is endlessly appealing. And The Running Man, has been something that I've wanted to do since I was a kid, since I read the novella and saw the Schwarzenegger movie and love the Schwarzenegger movie, but mm-hmm. really don't see it as an adaptation of Running Man. I mean, it's a, you know, it's fine. It is what it is. And right. it's fun and it's cartoonish and it is, you know, great, but I don't sort of feel as though anybody has ever really adapted the Bachman Running Man. So, mm-hmm. you know, that would obviously, I mean, that would be kind of beyond the dreams of avarice. I am continuing to pursue it. The answer has been that there is at least talk or fantasy or whatever it is of, you know, Paramount rebooting the feature franchise. So, maybe therefore they don't want to do it as a limited series, but or by the way, an unlimited series. I mean, to me, that's what The Running Man calls for. I think it's hard to really do justice to it as a feature. You know, I think you really want it to be an ongoing story where you can explore this, you know, this incredible world that he's rendered in that book. I just feel like that's a slam dunk. So yes, 100%
agree.
I keep my fingers crossed, and obviously if that comes to fruition, I will, you know, talk to you guys endlessly about it.
Oh, awesome. Well, we can't wait. And I guess I got one last question. Is this the last The Stand? Is there any special plans for release, like, or maybe bigger cuts of the episodes, anything in the future that fans can look forward to?
Well, that is a wonderful question. I mean, there has certainly been talk about deleted scenes or expanded stuff. I mean, as you assume, you know, there's so much material in that book that, you know, that obviously there was stuff that we just couldn't get into the show. I go back and forth on it. And frankly, at the moment, there aren't plans. I mean, I said, and we said that we didn't want to put deleted scenes on the box set or in the box set. And in part because, I don't know, this is the version that we made, and the cuts that we've made, and the one that we're presenting. And like, maybe in a certain amount of time, if people are interested, I mean, we can certainly revisit and show some of the stuff that didn't make it. But I very rarely feel that is additive. I mean, except except for people who are just, you know, who are studying the actual craft of it. But like Apocalypse Now, I mean, I'm not the only one, but Apocalypse Now is one of my favorite films of all time. But I thought Apocalypse Now redo, which I saw, you know, in the theaters when it came out, my sense with every scene that hadn't made it into the original cut, it was like, oh yeah, I get why they cut this. You know?
Yeah, I mean, most of the time the instincts are right. Yeah. When it comes to cutting room floor.
Totally. And the interminable, the interminable alien or aliens. Yes. Sorry, not alien, but aliens.
The 45 minutes or something. Yeah.
Yeah, with the family finding the thing. It's just like, right. I mean, you know, I get it. And I mean, I watched it and was interested in it, but I also felt like, oh no, clearly the greater movie was the one you guys released, and you were right to make this tough decision. And so, okay. I mean, you know, like, I don't know, but at the same time, you know, I've gone and looked at, I don't know, stuff like, you know, that I don't know, the version of Sun Also Rises that I, not to be too, you know, I'm not making these grand claims for us, but you know, you look at these great novels that, you know, have big sections that are cut out, and you go back as an interested reader and I suppose as a writer and creator, and sort of look at that stuff and potentially learn from it. But I don't think I've ever read or seen an expanded version of something and thought like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, this is the version that should have come out. Yeah. I mean, I guess there are a couple instances, but they're very specific, you know, where the creative, like in, you know, like Brazil or Blade Runner, where the creator really felt like, oh no, this was compromised. You know, these weren't choices that I made. This was compromised in the service of, you know, trying to make the material more accessible or, you know, more, I don't know, to that these were, you know, studio dictates, as opposed to just, you know, no, we're taking our, you know, we're being ruthless about the stuff that just doesn't work as well. And we're trying to, you know, tell a story and maintain our momentum and all that stuff. So maybe someday.
Okay.
But not right away, I don't think.
Well, we'll look forward to it.
Yeah. Good.
Until then, we loved what we got. This has been a lot of fun. This entire journey has just been a blast, and what a way to end 2020 and begin 2021. So thank you so much for joining us, not once, but twice. And we can't appreciate it enough, Benjamin. Thank you.
Well, thank you guys. What a pleasure.
Well, we'll talk soon, hopefully when we're lacing up for The Running Man.
Yes, indeed. Right. Oh, fingers crossed.
Yeah, definitely. Well, have a good one.
You too. Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
Well, there you have it. We are officially closing the book on The Stand. never going to happen again. We're not going to talk about this apocalyptic epic in the entirety of this podcast. I'm just joking. I mean, actually, what are the odds that we open? Well, I guess what are the odds that you open the book? Because you've read this book multiple times. So are you going to go back to it?
Well, I'm kind of in the middle of it again because I just wanted to read it again because it's so good. It's been a couple of years. Actually, maybe it's been about 10 years since I read it the last time, and just watching it now and seeing like this new interpretation of characters for better or worse. But like, I really think a lot of the characters in the show have kind of, those are going to be who I see going forward.
Yeah, I think so too. We did our comps in the last recap, but it is going to be, I think a lot of it just is the sense of newness, you know, and the fact that like things are refreshing in my head. I'd like to believe that there'd be like a hodgepodge of characters that when I eventually do dip back into the book, because I actually didn't reread it this year, this past year for the Stan CBS All Access.
You just relived it.
I think the reason why I didn't reread it was because we spent so much time on those recaps. Mm-hmm. For the 1994 miniseries, so I think at that point I was like, all right, I think I'm good. But that is
ready to sit down.
Yeah. But you're right. You are rereading it, and if you are still not getting enough Stan coverage, if the 8 hours or 10 hours book episodes that we did weren't enough, the multiple miniseries episodes that we did last year weren't enough, and that God knows how many hours of episodes we did for the Stan recap episodes, and you still want to stay in this post-apocalyptic world, the good news is that Jen is doing the recap right now.
That's right.
Reread.
Yeah.
So we have been sharing those chapters when you do post them. Where are you at right now currently?
I'm on chapter, I think, 37. I just got to the chapter, the final cut, in air quotes, where it's all the random people that didn't make it to Vegas.
That is like one of my favorite bits of the... Yeah. Was that added in to the books after for the expanded version, or was that...
I don't know. We're going to have to ask Dan Caffrey to confirm because I think he does have an original copy. And whenever I can't figure that out, I'm like, hey, Dan, can you check your text, please?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I feel like
that does seem like it would be an addition.
Because I know that the roundup of deaths around Boulder were the ones that I think that was added back in too, which I love. I love when King can kind of, you know, go off the beaten path a little bit in his books and give us some sort of side stories. But here's the good news. Stephen King, unlike the puzzle I just bought, which seems to duplicate multiple book covers of Stephen King, much to my chagrin, we have so many books to cover in Stephen King's Dominion. And we got two of them coming up. We got Desperation and The Regulators. Those are going to be back-to-back episodes. You're on those episodes, which is going to be, that's going to be exciting. I had to dip just because I'm going to be focusing on another book, episode that you're going to be getting, which is a newer one. None of us have read it yet. It's called Later. It's his brand new book. So, I mean, after a long reprieve of not having book episodes, even though we did give you two episodes of The Green Mile back in late November, December, so it wasn't too much of a reprieve, but we're going back to the stacks, baby, and we got a lot of books to cover. So,
big time.
Yeah, so it's very exciting, and, and as always, we're doing some side episodes. We're going to be dropping a special Valentine's Day-themed Bag of Bones episodes, which I'm recording tonight. That'll be fun. And that's going to be exclusive to Patreon, and if you aren't a member of our Patreon, please join us in the Barrens. www.patreon.com/thebarrens, and we're always doing fun stuff. That's actually an understatement, because we are doing a ton of fun stuff. We're doing Zoom hangouts now, which we've dubbed the Mellow Tiger Mellow Hour, which is fun. We have a whole Discord channel, which we're talking about things randomly all the time. I think one of the constant listeners called out the fact that we didn't get to see Alexander Skarsgård's dick this episode.
I know.
So always fun
stuff. It's a wasted opportunity.
Yeah, it is a wasted opportunity. Always lots of stuff going on here at the Losers Club. So, at the very least, you could follow us at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're always posting some of that fresh content that Randall likes to call. We don't ask a lot of you, but if you could you please give us some reviews on Apple Podcasts. You know, give us some bright red Pennywise clown noses, because, you know,
five
would be nice. I think we deserve it, because, you know, look, we are your favorite, we are your devoted, we are your only Losers Club.
Yep.
So until then, until the next hour or two that we get to spend on the mic together, we'll be seeing you over long days
and pleasant nights.
I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. But you know you want somebody to treat you good.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.